Today on Maine Calling, reporters' notes and reflections on the year in news. In many ways, covering news in Maine in 2025 was like stepping into a whirlwind, especially as journalists scrambled to keep up with the impact of executive orders and funding cuts from the Trump White House. But not all the big stories this year hit hard and fast. Some major Maine issues have been building for years. The crisis in Maine's court system, for example, or the state's housing shortage. Throughout the year, my colleagues, Maine public reporters, followed all of it with tenacity and dedication. I'm Jennifer Rooks. On this last day of 2025, we talk with our reporting team about the stories and trends of the past year. We'll hear what stood out to them and why. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. On this last day of 2025, we look back at a momentous year. To help us take stock, our Maine public reporting team joins us. They're going to share their insights about the big stories of the year and some of the not-so-big stories and the impact on the people and communities in Maine. With me for the hour are two of my colleagues, Nicole Ogrisco and Ari Snyder. You know their voices. They are both hosts of All Things Considered and also news reporters here at Maine Public. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Jen.
Thanks for having us.
And we invite you to join the conversation. What news and developments stood out to you this past year? What has changed? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. So you all are both really good sports, because I know this is hard. We haven't had much time to reflect on this year. But still, even though it's hard, I'm going to ask you to do it. I'm going to go first. Nicole, how would you characterize this year? How was it being a journalist in Maine in 2025?
It was busy. It was at times chaotic, especially from the host seat. There were definitely days where, you know, we were preparing for one thing, and then by 5 o'clock, which is when All Things Considered is on, the news had changed. So, it was busy. At times it was exhausting. I said to Ari earlier today, as I was kind of looking through the stories that I had worked on over the past year, I just kept getting kind of tired as I was scrolling through and looking at what we had covered. So, yeah, it was busy.
Yeah. Ari, what about you? How would you characterize the year?
Yeah, it was a crash course in breaking news, and news was breaking in all sorts of ways at all different times and on every conceivable beat and level. There were just so many days where things would kind of come out of nowhere, whether it was a new tariff regime, the rollback of a tariff regime, lawsuits. I'm on the immigration beat, so, you know, immigration arrests, learning of people that had been detained by ICE in various circumstances, and then hustling to try to figure out as much as I could about what had happened, where they were, whether they were still in the state, what the circumstances of their arrest were. So things were constantly moving, and it felt like even when there were days where something wasn't breaking immediately, we were all in this sort of like athletic position, crouched of like what is about to happen. You know, you really feel like you couldn't relax fully. You couldn't quite take your eye off the ball ever.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, Nicole, you mentioned that you're looking back at the year. I did the same thing. And I realized that January 27th, there was that earthquake. And I'm like, oh, that was last year? That seems like a decade ago, you know, that everybody was talking about the earthquake, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but as I mentioned at the top of the program, it seems like there were two kinds of stories this year, the kind that you all were just talking about, the kind that came hard and fast,
but also the ones that have been building for years. Ari, covering immigration definitely fit into that first category of where, you know, you didn't know day to day what was going to happen. But Nicole, you covered the housing beat, and that's sort of that other category. This is an issue that's really important right now, but it did not come out of nowhere. So tell me, what stood out to you on the housing beat this year?
Yeah, I mean, housing, it's a persistent challenge. And I think there were two big kind of broad stories that happened this past year. The one that was churning earlier in the year was the kind of ongoing debate at the state level about protecting residents who are in mobile home parks or manufactured housing communities. I think, you know, this is a response to the increasing number of parks that have been bought up by large out-of-state corporations. They've been known to raise the lot rents at much higher rates than maybe what the residents are used to. So throughout the legislative session in particular, there was a lot of work done to try to strengthen protections for mobile home residents. And I think that debate is really going to continue into 2026. I think rent control, rent stabilization is going to be an ongoing part of that debate. And, you know, at the end of the day, Jennifer, the mobile home issue, it really raises kind of the one of the buzzwords of the year, affordability, right? Manufactured housing, it's considered one of the last naturally occurring affordable housing types in the state, throughout the country, really. And, you know, these are communities that often have older people, people on fixed incomes living in them. And so these sudden lot rent increases are really tough. And, you know, we should say that most residents, they own their physical homes, but they don't own the land underneath them, which is why this topic is challenging. So I think we're going to continue to hear more about that in the coming year. And then the other one was a story that was actually discussed on your show pretty early on, and those were federal funding cuts to homelessness services. So kind of a complicated story here, but in the fall, the Trump administration changed some policies, essentially shifting away from providing permanent supportive housing or rapid rehousing in favor of short-term shelter-type arrangements. And as a result, that meant that Maine could lose about two-thirds of the funding that it provides for those services. And that really was a big moment toward the end of this year, really. And, you know, the state at one point estimated that if those policy changes had gone through, I mean, like 1,200 people could lose their housing and potentially become homeless. And ultimately, this debate ended up the way a lot of debates this past year have gone under the Trump administration. You know, a group of states, including Maine, sued the administration. A judge temporarily blocked these policy changes from going forward, at least for now. And so we're kind of in this limbo period.
It's a lot to keep track of.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And I think the lawsuits in particular that we've seen throughout this past year, and I know Ari can comment on this too, it's been tough to juggle them all and, you know, note where they are at each step of the way. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Ari, pick up on that. You know, you were talking about finding out that someone had been arrested or something like that, but also just what the policy is when it comes to immigration and ICE activity. That in and of itself has been hard to keep up on.
Totally. And the changes coming from the federal administration have been just so fast paced. And what we've seen both in immigration and in all sorts of different beat areas is that the policies will get rolled out. It'll be either a memo or an executive order, and it won't be entirely clear what it means, right? Like, I will be calling immigration lawyers, I'll be calling civil rights activists, other groups, and saying, you know, what does this mean? And they're saying, we don't know. We're trying to figure this out. The language can be vague from the executive orders, from these policy memos that get put in place, whether that has to do with cutting the validity period of a work permit for asylum seekers, whether that comes to the revocation of temporary protected status, which is a certain category of federal protection for certain immigrants. You know, we see these changes getting rolled out, and then there's often a scramble on the ground to figure out what does this actually mean. You know, there were many days where I was calling immigration lawyers, and they were saying, we don't know yet. We're still trying to figure this out ourselves, and the lawsuits as well, because that's something that we sort of realized earlier on in the year is that we would get this sort of huge policy change announced by the White House that would often be very broad and often very vague. And then we would be scrambling to figure out what that meant for Maine. Other groups in Maine would be, you know, scrambling to figure out what it meant for them. And then there would be this sort of cycle almost where big policy gets announced, a lawsuit gets filed. Maine Attorney General Aaron Fry was filing a ton of lawsuits in collaboration with other Democratic attorneys general around the state. Around the country. And then there would be maybe an injunction and a partial reprieve and then an appeal and then a reinstatement of the original order, all sorts of different things. And so tracking the long-term effect has been quite challenging because the initial order often isn't the final piece of policy.
And I wonder too, Ari, about when you're covering immigration, you're trying to tell personal stories. I'm guessing that might be difficult on a personal level, that there might be times when people wanted to talk to you, wanted to tell you their story, but all, at the same time were also fearful that just talking to you might put them in a compromising position. Did that happen?
Jen, that's an incredibly good question because that happened all the time. I mean, I've been reporting on immigration in Maine since 2021. It's never been easy for people arriving, right? Coming as an asylum seeker, coming as a refugee, there's always going to be challenges. People were, you know, often sensitive about sharing their identities. This year, entirely new landscape. People are so afraid of any repercussion of speaking to the media, of putting their name out there. Could this draw unnecessary, attention that they don't want from ICE or Border Patrol? Could it impact the immigration cases of their loved ones who are in detention, which is oftentimes what I'm, trying to learn about, right? I'm trying to contact family members of people who've been arrested, who've been detained, who've been deported in certain cases. And so there have been, to me, sort of almost a surprising number of people who are willing to go on the record with me. And we've done a number of stories this year about the personal impact on people who've been arrested. You know, I've even had folks call me from immigration detention to speak about their cases, talk to loved ones, talk to family members, and talk to people after they've been released. Because, of course, many people are able to get released on bond. And those are the folks who tend to be more willing to speak to me because they're back at home. They're back in their community. But getting the information and getting the personal stories has been far, far more difficult than in previous years.
Mm. Joining us on the line now is Kevin Miller, Maine Public State House correspondent, and along with Steve Missler, part of our Political Pulse team. Thanks for calling in, Kevin.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
Good. I know that you're going to be coming back right in the new year for a show all about political news. So I'm just going to ask a couple quick questions and then we'll come back to you in 2026.
Sure.
But the two big political stories of the year, number one, Governor Mills and Donald Trump.
Yeah, this is quite a year in Maine politics. I'd kind of use Nicole's word, chaotic. That was definitely one of the huge ones. You know, this began back in February when a Republican state lawmaker posted on social media about a transgender athlete winning a girls' track championship. That post went viral. Days later, we had that just incredible scene at the White House where President Trump threatened to withhold federal funding from Maine unless Maine banned transgender athletes from girls' sports, and Governor Mills responded, quote, "See you in court." You know, and I think since then, Maine has really undeniably been in the crosshairs of the Trump administration. They've tried to cut off federal funding. They've launched multiple lawsuits and investigations, and they even briefly tried to prevent new parents in Maine from getting Social Security numbers for their newborns at the hospital. I mean, that was just a bizarre brief, controversy. But that, I'd say, really kind of set the tone politically for things here in Maine, both between the Mills administration and the new Trump White House, and even the situation here at the State House.
Yeah. Also, big news, even though it's not going to happen till November of 2026, is all the people who've entered the races for governor, for Senate, for second congressional district, but one name kind of has gotten most attention.
Yeah, it certainly has, and that's probably, I imagine you're thinking of Graham Plattner, maybe?
Yep.
And you know, this also is interesting. It ties back in some ways to that big transgender rights issue, because Democrats and not just transgender, but the Democratic frustration with what they saw as the party establishment's weak response to the Trump White House. And Graham Platner got in August, and he just kind of took, you know, his campaign just caught fire. And he held these events drawing more than 1,000 people. And we really don't see that kind of enthusiasm in Maine for candidates. But the reason I say it kind of goes back to the transgender athletes issue. After that big showdown at the White House, there were a lot of people that wanted Governor Mills, you know, to get into the race to challenge Susan Collins because they saw her as being this rare example of a Democrat standing up to Trump. But she didn't do it until October. And by that point, Graham Platner had been in the race for 2 months. So now we have this really interesting race shaping up for next year, obviously, between Mills and Platner and, you know, other Democrats kind of vying for that nomination. So it really kind of stems from this, just this chaos and this, you know, fury among Democrats about how their party hasn't been in adequate, you know, opposition to Trump at this point.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin. That was Kevin Miller. And Kevin, we'll see you back here on Maine Calling January 6th.
Great. Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from our colleague, reporter, and host, Patty White. She covers health care for Maine Public, and she pre-recorded this update on health news of the year.
So one of the big stories of the year in healthcare was the loss of Medicaid funding for Planned Parenthood and Maine Family Planning. And this was part of President Trump's big, beautiful budget bill that passed over the summer. It blocks healthcare providers that also offer abortion care from receiving Medicaid reimbursements. And that's a big hit to these organizations. Planned Parenthood in Maine is losing $1 million a year. Maine Family Planning is losing nearly $2 million a year. And as a result, they ended primary care services. And that affected about 800 patients who use their clinics in rural areas of the state in Ellsworth, Holton, and Presque Isle. And both organizations have filed separate legal challenges, and those cases are pending. So this is a story that will continue into next year. And, of course, another major healthcare story this year is the expiration of the enhanced premium tax credits on the Affordable Care Act's marketplace. Those expire today. And the push to extend these enhanced subsidies has been going on for a while. I mean, advocates have been urging Congress to take action since 2024, and it was the cause of the federal government shutdown this year. But Democrats and Republicans have not been able to agree on this. About 54,000 Mainers currently get these enhanced premium tax credits. They're facing average premium increases next year of 77%. And some consumers have told Maine Public that their premiums are jumping exponentially from $100 or $200 a month to well over $1,000 a month. And this has big implications even for people who don't buy their insurance on the ACA marketplace, because if people with these plans drop coverage because they're unaffordable, that's likely going to result in more uncompensated care. And many hospitals and providers are already struggling financially. They're not going to be able to absorb that cost. So it's going to drive up the cost of healthcare for everyone. The story on these enhanced premium tax credits isn't quite over yet. Congress is expected to vote on whether to extend them in early January.
That was the voice of Maine Public's host and healthcare reporter Patty White. We are going to take a quick break. This is our Reporters Roundup, the year in review. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are hearing from our Maine Public reporting team today about the top stories of 2025. With me for the hour, two of our Maine Public hosts and reporters, Ari Snyder and Nicole Ogrisco. We invite you to join the conversation. What news struck you as particularly significant this year? Send us a brief email, talk@mainecalling.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I spoke with another Maine Public reporter, Maddie Smith, to hear about her coverage of education. Maddie is our Emerging Voices Journalism Fellow. Here's what she had to say. So Maddie, you are our Emerging Voices Journalism Fellow, which means this is fairly early in your reporting career. And I just wanted to ask you what this year has felt like as a young reporter.
I mean, it's been great. I've learned so much this year about, you know, the state of Maine and radio reporting in general. And I've really enjoyed the opportunity to kind of like sink my teeth into a beat. It's been great to report on education this year. And I've really learned a lot. So it's been a great year.
You talked about education being your beat. What were a couple of the issues that stood out to you in the world of education this year?
Yeah, so there was a plenty of things, as always. There's so many schools in the state. There's a lot of things happening. I would say the big story across the country in education had to do with federal education changes, either to policy or funding. One of the biggest ways that that touched the state was through grants to the University of Maine system and other colleges. A lot of those were revoked at the beginning of the year. Some have come back, some are still waiting, and this kind of process has continued. So that's something that kept my eye on throughout the year and will keep my eye on next year as well. Another big thing, and this is, all tied together. I kind of talked about these as the three C's of education. I'm coining this, but I'm enjoying it, is kind of the idea of school construction, school consolidation, and school closure. All three of these things are really tied together and are really interesting here in Maine with declining enrollment and declining infrastructure, really. So there's a lot of tension and conversation on all three of those topics in the state right now. The big story that I reported last year was that there was more school closures in 2025 than 2024. So these are things that have been an issue in Maine and really across the country for a long time, but really feel like they're coming to a head right now. And I know a lot of school districts are really having this conversation now. And another big issue would kind of be the transgender schools issue. That's touched a lot of beats and has been a big story for the entire state this year. That's going to continue into next year. There's a few school boards that is currently in litigation over some of their anti-trans school board policies. So I was at a few school board meetings this last week, and that's something that litigation will definitely continue into the next year, and I'll be covering that as well.
Well, Maddie, thank you so much for joining us and happy holidays.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks for having me.
Again, Maddie Smith, our Emerging Voices Journalism Fellow. She's been covering education for us at Maine Public Radio. Joining us now, Nora Sachs, who is one of Maine Public's newer reporters. Thanks so much for calling, Nora.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jen.
You had a chance to cover some interesting stories this year. Tell us about Matinicus.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. That was one of the first stories I pitched when I started at Maine Public 6 months ago. I had always wanted to go to Matinicus, but never had a good reason. And when we got a press release about a new one-woman play happening there about a historical heroine, I just, my face lit up and I was like, this is it. And so I got to, with the blessing of our editors, fly out there on a tiny plane and then essentially embed with the wonderful folks from Seacoast Mission who were helping the Penobscot Theater Company put on a one-woman play about Abby Burgess, who was a teenage heroine from Matinicus who helped keep the lighthouse going on Matinicus Rock while her father was, supposedly kept on land during a storm. And this happened, I think, 150 years ago. And since I didn't grow up in Maine, I didn't know the story, but I soon came to learn that on Matinicus, especially for women, this story is like theirs. It's their thing, And so the actress who was in the play did a fabulous job, and it was so affirming to see the island community come out to help them put it on. And as the actor, Katie Peabody said, she felt like she was sharing this story with the Matinicus residents rather than telling it. And all these people swarmed her after the performance to just give her hugs and cry and tell her how much it meant for them to like see this story performed for their sake. So that was a really meaningful experience.
Oh, wonderful. Now, I want to also ask you about your story about training loggers. What did you learn?
Yeah, so I knew that Maine, as many of us know, has a lot of forests and a really important wood products industry. But what I didn't know was that there's a lot of attrition in logging, a lot of folks who are retiring or aging out, and not as many folks coming into the industry. And so there's a program, it's not really new, but it's put on by the professional logging contractors of the Northeast in tandem with some community colleges that basically take people with zero experience operating heavy machinery, and then in, I think, 4 or 5 months, train them up on how to use all these incredible machines, and give them their commercial driver's license if they pass. And then in a very short amount of time, they can enter the industry. And so this is one attempt by the logging industry and wood products industry to help kind of stem the bleeding, I guess, of folks getting out of it. And in reporting that story, I not only got to see 18-year-olds operating feller bunchers, but I also got to talk to some, you know, really veteran loggers who were talking about just the challenge of keeping their business going and passing it on to the next generation. And that really humanized the issue for me.
Well, what a great experience that was. Nora, thanks for calling in. Nora Sachs, a reporter here at Maine Public Radio. We'll go really quickly to a call from the public. Carol in Portland. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much. Love what all of you do. You keep me sane during these chaotic times. And I just wondered how you manage, you as reporters, with all that from in a day you have five different things, blips coming from nationally, more than we've ever had, at least in my memory, and I've been around a while.
Carol, that's a great question. I'll throw it to you, Nicole. How do you do it?
I mean, it's challenging. It really is. I think it's just a matter of being organized. I'm thinking especially about hosting an afternoon show when, you know, for example, I think about one of many, it seemed, tariff days, as in days where it seemed like we were going to have major news about Canadian tariffs going into effect. And, you know, we all spent the whole day pretty much calling people, seeking reactions about a variety of different industries that this could impact. And then by 5 o'clock, the president had changed his mind and said that, you know, this was going to be paused for, you know, however much time. And we had to pivot and look for something else to lead off the top of the show.
So your short answer is, Carol, to Carol, is you don't know how you do it. Ari, what about you?
Well, I would say that part of how we do it, and it sort of has to happen on the fly often, is we do work together very well. And I said that I think that's been one of the biggest strengths of this year, is we really need to rely on each other in our newsroom. And Nicole, I'm thinking of a day that we have termed the great host swap of 2025, in which I don't even remember what month it was, maybe January or February, it was early on. And there was some just breaking immigration news that just there was just a lot going on. And Nicole and I were sort of tag teaming this reporting, and I think I was scheduled to host that night, but because of the reporting I was doing, Nicole stepped up to host so that I could finish this longer story and we could get it all on air for the evening. So we've had to react really quickly and we've had to do it together.
Oh, wow. Well, Carol, thanks for the question. We're going to go now to Peter McGuire. He covers the climate beat for Maine Public. Hi, Pete. Thanks for calling in.
Absolutely. Hi, Jen. Thanks for having me.
It seems kind of hard to remember now and hard to believe, but heat and how hot it was a big topic for us this year. What were your takeaways for reporting on the impacts of heat in Maine?
Yeah, exactly. It is hard to think about now that it's the cold depths of winter, but we had some stretches of time in Maine where, you know, it was triple digits. And for a cold weather state, that's really hard for a lot of people to handle. But it's going to be increasingly more of our reality. So our project really dived into, you know, what are the effects of this kind of dangerous heat, and what does a cold weather state like Maine need to do to prepare for the future? And we found, you know, that, you know, we're expanding cooling centers in the summer. You know, workers are kind of being more prepared and more cautious about working in the heat. And just generally this idea that this is a serious and extreme weather event is really kind of like becoming more of the consciousness, and people are really taking it a lot more seriously.
Mm. You also cover the important topic of energy, because climate's not a big enough beat. what stood out for you for 2025?
Yeah, I mean, the energy beat is endlessly complicated and endlessly exciting if you're someone like me. But it absolutely touches all of our lives, and it's going to dominate, I think, our conversations in 2026. There's becoming this real kind of, I don't want to say clash, but a tension between these goals that states like Maine have to really push down fossil fuel consumption, especially in the electricity sector. And, you know, these problems with affordability, you know, prices for electricity, electric bills are just absolutely soaring in the state. You saw this just a couple of months ago when the Maine Public Utilities Commission took this extraordinary step and rejected Central Maine Power's request for a rate increase, kind of out of hand. And that's something they've never done. And it was absolutely driven in large part by just an absolutely outpouring of just outrage from CMP customers who said, we just can't afford this anymore. So I think that this is going to come up a lot in the new year, this kind of tension between expanding clean energy and the cost of it and just where we go in Maine and the region for the future.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for calling in. Peter McGuire, Maine Public's climate and energy reporter. And joining us now, Caitlin Badayan, who is Maine Public's Bangor correspondent. Caitlin, let's start with Washington County, the debt situation there. That's a big story.
Absolutely. And it's really boiled over in attention here in the last couple of months, you know, that, as you can imagine, county finance situations are very complex. But, you know, sort of the shortest description there has been that over the last couple of years with some poor accounting habits, the county has really unknowingly spent down all of their reserve funds. And here at the end of the year, they have this $8 million loan that is due to be paid back, and they don't have the funds for it. So in November, the county had put out a bond referendum for voters to look to take out a loan to, you know, well, take out a bond to pay back the loan. And that was rejected. So in the last month or so since then, they've asked individual towns to voluntarily make a payment for their share of that loan in the hopes of maybe not entirely paying it off, but certainly paying it down by the end of the year.
A more fun kind of story you got to cover was that you got to be in Newport for draft night. We have not yet mentioned Cooper Flag on Maine Calling, but we cannot talk about 2025 without talking about Cooper Flag. What was it like to be in Newport, Maine for NBA draft night?
It was incredibly exciting. It feels an awfully long time ago, but there was so much excitement in Newport. It seemed that there were just so many different parties that the locals were putting on to watch the draft and to celebrate Cooper Flag. And really everyone there was so excited to see him succeed and so ready to follow him to whatever professional team he ended up on. You know, I talked to a lot of folks from Newport who had lots of stories at the ready about Cooper Flag and the rest of the Flag family and people from other parts of Maine that came out to be, you know, just a little bit closer to him on this big night. And, you know, had followed him to Duke and were ready to see him in the NBA, wherever that was.
Well, Caitlin, thanks for calling in. Caitlin Badayan is our Bangor-based correspondent here at Maine Public Radio. We're going to go to Jay calling from North Yarmouth. Hi, Jay. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon. I just wanted to make a quick comment, and it's on the Mills entering the national stage. I was listening the day that she spoke with Trump at the luncheon. And the first thing she said was, I will follow the law. And then in the subsequent interchange, it got into that whole court thing. So I would like to say that in 25, she set the tone for somebody who will follow the law versus Trump's track record of breaking the law and getting overturned in court with his bad decisions. So I will follow the law. That was the best quote of 25.
Jay, thanks so much for calling in and joining the conversation. We are talking about the year in news on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is our end of 2025 year in review show. And it was a doozy. We are hearing from Maine Public's reporting team. With me for the hour, Nicole Ogrisco and Ari Snyder, both of them hosts of All Things Considered, as well as reporters for Maine Public. If you have a minute or even 30 seconds, share your comments and questions. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. You can also give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We now have Carol Bousquet on the line. Carol is also a host of All Things Considered and a news reporter for Maine Public. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, good morning, Jen. Thanks for having me.
I understand you have been thinking about this and thinking about the activism that you covered and reported on.
It really started even before Trump was inaugurated. The weekend before the inauguration, 1,000 residents attended the People's March in Portland to call for unity and collective action with him poised to take over. And as we know, once he was sworn in, he started writing executive orders to do all sorts of damage, alleged damage, I guess. And so the rallies continued for labor rights, for immigration and due process, protests about his plan to cut 10,000 jobs from the U.S. Postal Service, and then the No Kings rallies about protecting democracy continued all year long. And I was just really struck by the amount of activism in residents across the state. It was amazing.
Yeah, and I saw that Maine made some ranking for being, you know, per capita, one of the most activist states this year. You also covered Canada. Canada was very much in the news here in Maine, our neighbors.
Yeah, the relationship between Maine and Canada is really important. And Trump's rhetoric about Canada becoming the 51st state angered Canadians to the point where they wouldn't come to Maine for vacation. And hospitality businesses took a hit of 10 to 18% fewer bookings. They had to refund thousands of dollars from Canadians that wouldn't come. So it became a big problem, and Governor Mills met with them. Hospitality businesses in York County, and she was among Northeastern governors who met with Canadian premiers from Nova Scotia and New Brunswick to take up the trade wars and try to find common ground. And I know tariffs have come up, and Nora was just talking about the logging industry. Tariffs on aluminum cans for craft breweries, on steel, and now forest products and lumber, one of Maine's economic drivers. So it's been a tense year, and I've heard from one of our state reps that some of the small loggers aren't even running their operations right now because there's no market for them to sell their products. So it's going to be a tense time for some time.
I have to ask you about a lighter topic. You had a funny reporting experience involving a certain bird.
I did. I was talking to Bessie Fowler of Seeds of Hope. It's a warming center in Biddeford. And I kept hearing this racket in the background. And I said, Bessie, what's going on? And she said, oh, those are just the comfort parakeets. And she says, they hear me talking, and if nobody answers, they feel like they have to answer. So she had to cover the birds. And then at the news meeting later that day, it turns out that both Ari and Nicole had calls with parrots or birds on them. And we just thought that that was rather comical.
So, okay, before we let you go, Nicole and Ari, you have to share your bird stories. Nicole?
Speaking with someone from down east Maine, I believe, was organizing the first Lost Fisherman's Memorial event, and she mentioned that she needed to be in a different room because she had a parrot of some kind, and just filed that away and, you know, sort of laughed about it to myself. And then I do remember overhearing Carol's phone call and wondering if she also was speaking with someone who had a parrot at home. And Ari, you've had that experience too.
Yeah, I was speaking with an economist about a fairly serious and extensive report about the potential economic and cultural benefits of land repatriation for the Wabanaki tribes in Maine. And we're deep into this report, and he's making some really sort of important and key points about the report. And there's this screeching in the background. I said, James, I'm sorry. I don't mean to cut you off, but like, what is that sound in the background? Are you outside? Are there birds? He goes, oh, that's my daughter's parrot. Should I move it? And I said, unfortunately, probably, yeah, you know, because I don't want, I don't want your good quotes cut off by the parrot.
Well, there, one of the themes of the year, parrots and parakeets, the year of the parrot at Maine Public Radio. Carol, thanks so much for calling in.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's been fun. Thanks.
And happy new year. We'll let's see. Quickly go to David calling from Bucksport. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I am the guy who started Solidarity Bucksport 5.5 years ago, and we have been meeting consistently every Saturday on the bridge between Bucksport and Verona Island. So thrilled to have the comments regarding the increase in activism nationally, and specifically the fact that Maine was in the top 10 of states that had the most number of activism events. And my perspective standing on that bridge every Saturday for 5.5 years is that the crowd response has maintained its level of about 95% supportive drive-by traffic, the other 5% angry with us for holding signs and exercising our right to freedom of speech. What I'm most cognizant of is the fact that our numbers consistently are growing, but there's new people almost every week that show up, and their statement is they just can't stand by anymore and watch this happening. So I'm inviting everybody in the listening audience, take that leap, join the closest event of social activism that you can find in your area, and let's keep Maine in the top 10 for the next year as we respond as a society to the stuff that's happening that requires public response, public activism.
David, thank you for calling in. We're going to go now from another of our newer colleagues. I spoke with him earlier and pre-recorded this interview. This is Michael Livingston, the Maine Public Reporter covering agriculture and rural Maine. Michael, I know that it's hard for you to say what the year has been like here in Maine because you started in August. Given that, though, you've covered some pretty important issues, especially having to do with agriculture in Maine. What were your first big stories?
Yeah, I would divide up my time so far into three different phases. And that first phase was coming in right when harvest season started to get going. And of course, what was on everybody's mind was the intense drought that was felt pretty much all over the state. And, you know, I did a story looking at an aspect that wasn't being talked about a lot, which is how fields, feed, and hay crops were being affected, sort of going to different cattle farms, you know, livestock farms, things like that, and having farmers kind of walk me through their fields and tell me, like, all of this grass should be, you know, up to our ankles right now, but it's only touching, you know, the bottom of our shoes, and how that went into, you know, having to order grain and feed from out of state, having to pay extra money to keep the farms going, not having a stockpile to save up for the winter, and just, you know, the headache that that was already causing an already very turbulent time for farmers, what with tariffs, what with, you know, consolidation, things like that. So it was a good introduction into the agriculture beat, being able to talk to those farmers and discover what their troubles were.
Your beat has not been insulated from the effect of the changes brought on by the Trump administration. Big headline about what may happen in the future with SNAP benefits those that used to be called food stamps.
Right. That's sort of the second phase of what my time here has been so far. We get into an October when the government shutdown happens. And of course, SNAP funding was sort of on the line. And you had a lot of specifically food pantries preparing for a large volume of people coming in that might not have as much money on their EBT cards, having to get food and resources for their family through those organizations. A lot of places in Augusta were preparing. I interviewed the Bread of Life Soup Kitchen, also went to the Augusta Food Pantry there, and just hearing over and over again that without those benefits in place, they were preparing for a large influx of people using those resources. And of course, we saw local businesses sort of step up and offer, you know, limited time deals for the month of October, planning to go into November as well. But of course, you know, I had stories planned about what this crisis would mean. And then out of nowhere, the government reopens and sort of everything shifts back. So it was a very turbulent October for sure.
Speaking of turbulent, you've decided to take on I was going to be sarcastic and say a really easy topic, but I'll just say the topic of county budgets. Oh boy, talk about a complicated one, and one it seems like is an iceberg.
Yeah, now we're getting into phase three, November and December, where we're hearing over and over again as the counties get into their budget planning phases for next fiscal year, you know, the huge shortfalls and deficits that they're experiencing for one reason or another. You know, it could be actual, you know, money mismanagement. It could be, you know, shortfalls with certain services. I did a story focusing on county jail expenditures and how those have increased in recent years due to, you know, increased state mandates, also just due to general rising expenses and inflation and the efforts to get the state to pay more for, you know, county jail operations so it doesn't eventually fall to the property taxpayers. You know, it's a story with one of those endings where you don't really know what's going to happen next. Counties are still dealing with this. A lot of them say that they're in a budget crisis, but we'll see, you know, as the legislator gets into session, how, you know, state lawmakers are going to deal with that issue that we're seeing kind of in all counties right now.
As you look back on your few months here, Michael, was there anything that, I don't know, surprised you or struck you about what you've learned about Maine so far?
Mainers are very, very nice people. I've come across like a lot of folks that were just so excited about being interviewed, so much love for Maine public and public radio in general. That definitely surprised me. Coming from the Midwest, where we're kind of known for our niceness, it was nice to also see the Mainers show that welcoming energy to me.
Well, Michael, thank you for taking a few minutes with us and happy holidays.
Yeah, thank you. Happy holidays.
That was Maine Public reporter Michael Livingston. Speaking of the love for Maine Public, we have an email here from Steve. He writes, I just wanted to say thank you to Nicole and Ari and the other members of the Maine Public team for their excellent news coverage. So thank you very much, Steve, for taking the time to send that email. Now on the line, a voice you know very well, Erwin Gratz, Maine Public's longtime Morning Edition host and producer. Thanks for taking part, Erwin. Hi.
Hi, Jennifer. It's great. It's been great listening to all the stories that have been transpiring this year and keeping our people busy. And, you know, there's been so much stuff going on. I joke with my friends that I must have newsman's disease because there are so many of these events that actually makes coming to work a little more exciting for me. But I thought about a way to actually sum up the year and realize it may actually be more useful to consider what didn't happen this year. So think about this. No hurricanes made landfall in the United States this year. The war in Ukraine did not end. President Trump did not get the Nobel Peace Prize. The president talked a lot about, but didn't propose either reforms or elimination of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. We haven't seen final U.S. Supreme Court decisions or even hearings on matters of interest to Maine, including birthright citizenship or transgender athletes' rights in Maine schools. Actually, we did see the hearing on birthright citizenship, but we're still waiting for a ruling. There was no congressional action this year about either putting us on permanent daylight time or standard time. NASA has not sent its Artemis II crew yet to orbit the moon. And last but not least, the Mets didn't make the playoffs this year.
Well, Erwin, that's quite a list. You do like to cover space, though, and one story we haven't mentioned just happened. Just announced. What's going to happen for Jessica Meir next. Tell us about it.
Yeah, she's going to go up back to the space station for a second tour of duty. Her flight will leave, as NASA says, no earlier than February 15th, which means it's probably scheduled for the 15th when their launch window will open. She'll be there for at least another half a year along with the three other astronauts who are going up. Three astronauts are already aboard. The International Space Station currently has a crew of seven on board. So that'll be exciting, I'm sure, for her. People may also remember Jessica was involved in the first all-female spacewalks outside the station. The crew that she's going up with, I believe, also includes another woman, and astronauts from Europe and but that'll be happening in early February. And by the way,
and a cosmonaut.
And a cosmonaut. Thank you, Russ. I knew that I was missing something. And the other thing that may happen in February is NASA may get that Artemis II crew to lift off and launch it on its 10-day voyage around the moon, a flight kind of similar to what Apollo 8 did many, many years ago. But that'll be very exciting if that happens.
Erwin, thanks for closing out our show. Erwin Kratz, of course, Maine Public's Morning Edition host and producer. And thank you, Nicole and Ari, for being with us for the hour. Nicole Ogrisco and Ari Snyder are All Things Considered hosts and reporters here at Maine Public. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. The show is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Happy New Year, everybody. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.